Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Tara Sonnenschein. She's Undersecretary of State for Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy. Prior to her arrival at the State Department, she held a number of positions related to diplomacy and foreign affairs, and she also has an extensive background in broadcast media, including a decade of award-winning experience as an editorial producer for ABC's Nightline. Undersecretary Sonnenschein, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
Well, let me start with your title, which is, I think, for people unfamiliar with the State Department, perhaps a bit curious, Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. Could you explain what public diplomacy is in the context of the State Department? And more specifically, isn't diplomacy what the State Department is generally about? So why does it need its own sub-department?
Well, firstly, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to talk to your publics and your listeners about public diplomacy and public affairs. What it really is that we live in an age where simply governments talking to governments is not really enough. For policies to be very effective in the 21st century, we really have to engage with publics and with citizens. So public diplomacy is really about engagement, engaging people to people, citizens to citizens, but with the view toward explaining our national narrative, who we are, and doing it in a way that advances our national interests by also participating in the international conversation.
So could you give me a couple recent initiatives that you've undertaken under this banner then of this type of public diplomacy?
Sure. One recent example would be we had a Somali hip-hop artist work with us at the State Department to talk about his work. His name is Shine, and to try to explain why we feel it's so important to counter violent extremism around the world. And he was able to explain it to citizens in Kenya and all around the world from the perspective of an artist. So we were really helping to leverage a message to citizens through the art of dance and hip-hop, and that can be a very powerful form of engaging people beyond just saying we should counter violent extremism. It's quite different when you actually use a creative medium to do that.
Well, and I was going to ask this question later, but what you just said there makes me want to jump in with it now, and I'm sure you knew that I was going to ask you about the what public diplomacy means in the context of the event of the reaction to the Innocence of Muslims film. But it brought up in my mind what you just said there, the more general problem that seems to suggest to me, which is issues of control and message. That sounds like an interesting example, but how do you distinguish a person speaking on behalf of a government or a country and not? Because one of the problems, as I understand it, with the reaction to that film is that some people took it as some kind of statement of the United States government, which, of course, it wasn't.
It is very important at times that we differentiate, obviously and very clearly, what is a U.S. government-sponsored program or an exchange program, and what is something that is just simply out there in the world of freedom of expression. And I think part of it is the credibility of saying we fund something like this Somali artist, and if it's very clear, I think we forget that people are very smart in the world. They understand when you're very upfront about what you're doing and who you are, that they can take from it the difference between this is a U.S. government-sponsored program versus this is some Hollywood film that got online and we distance ourselves from it. So I think if you're credible, honest, straightforward and direct with citizens, they can decide if they like the message and the messenger.
So what is the articulated relationship, to take the example you gave me or perhaps some other ones you might want to give me here, the articulated relationship between the people doing the public diplomacy for the aims of the government and for the aims of the nation and the government itself? What do you say to people about that?
Well, firstly, there are short-term, mid-term, and long-term ways you connect with people. Every day, the State Department podium has a spokesperson who is explaining American foreign policy from the State Department. And that's pretty clear on a day-to-day basis what it is. If we set up an exchange program through the State Department, it's also clear that the person coming from Pakistan to the U.S. or from the U.S. to Pakistan is on a State Department-funded exchange. What happens to those two people as they live in one another's country over the year is not something we're going to control. And we're not going to message them and try to manage their experience. Part of this is we can leverage, we can initiate, and then it's up to those people on their exchange to have their own exchange and to go back. And we trust in our values and our system and our country that if you come here, you're going to come away with a positive cultural and educational experience. And we find when people go overseas, they come back with an appreciation for another country. So you can't control all these experiences.
And I'm guessing that this has involved a bit of a culture shift at the State Department. I'm employing a stereotype of impression, but I associate it with a fairly high degree of control over what the message is and being fairly careful about what's said. Has that been something that you've dealt with in your position?
What I've dealt with, and we can go straight to it, is the challenge now of social media, which really is a medium designed not to control, if you will. And so it's been a brave new world. It's a world that Secretary Clinton has embraced for the State Department, calling it 21st century statecraft. But the embrace of social networking by a government is in and of itself a reflection of its confidence and comfort level, because you cannot control every tweet and retweet, every blog, every email.
But I guess it seems to me, though, that thinking of that enterprise, say, for an agency in the federal government that primarily works with domestic issues, I don't know, the Education Department, Labor Department, would be one thing. But, you know, again, you're the face and the voice of the U.S. government to the world. So there's got to be some tension there that you're dealing with right now, I would think.
There are tensions day to day in the complex economic, political, social environment of a global community. But it's not much different from the tensions in any neighborhood that you might have. I tend to think about the global community as a neighborhood. And there will be tensions between neighbors, and there will be fights, and there might even be wars and conflicts. What you have to do in public diplomacy is ride the wave. You've got to get beyond the day-to-day political vicissitudes and conflicts of the moment and be in something for the long haul. Because over time, you find that individuals want some of the same things in the long term. They want economic security. They want physical security. They want the ability to educate their children in schools devoid of violence. They want to be able to have dignity and a voice and express their God-given potential. So once you embrace that as your long journey, you do have to go through the ups and downs of daily news cycles.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Undersecretary of State Tara Sonenshein. Well, I want to flip the question that I asked you before around and think about the perception of people abroad when they get the messages or they receive the communication that you might be fostering through these public diplomacy channels as to the question of its authenticity. Take the hip-hop person, for example. If I'm getting that and I'm seeing that person, but then I have this sense of, well, this is the government sponsoring this person. Do I then see it as somehow less authentic?
Sure. If something is a program that is set up by the State Department, there may be some who say, well, then it's going to reflect the State Department. I'm okay with that, again, because I think there are plenty of citizens who start out skeptical about engagement, and all the studies we've been doing, real in-depth studies show that people may be suspicious when they engage with the other at the beginning. But over time, walls break down. And over time, what happens when individuals communicate, both in their brains, actually, which neuroscience is beginning to show, and in their thinking and attitudes, they shift. Human beings are capable of making shifts. So if you are honest with them about who's setting up the program, who's delivering the message, who's putting the resources into something, you can spark an interesting engagement experience that even the most cynical might come around to find constructive.
And that reminds me of one of the tenets of the use of social media. You already brought up social media, is that kind of transparency is sort of rule number one. If you don't have that, you're out of the game from the beginning.
No hiding online.
Well, let me shift gears and ask you to look at a little bit broader and think about the history of this. Given the past 10 years and much of the world's negative reaction to the United States' actions in the world, do you view your mission, at least partially, as one of repairing relations?
I think the way to think about this is not so much repair, which has the sense of a sort of fix-it handy man or handy woman trying to repair damage. I think what you're trying to do is bridge. And I think a bridge still is a more constructive metaphor, and a network is a constructive metaphor, which is that you're trying to engage people in a network of conversation in which positive things can develop through cultural, educational, political, social familiarity, if you will.
I wanted to push you a little bit on the question that I just asked you before. And again, thinking about this in the context of the last 10 years, you know, when you look at the polling and public opinion data from around the world, I mean, there was a clear effect of America's actions in the last 10 years in a negative way on what most people in the world thought about the United States and its presence. So I understand, I think I understand what you're saying about this being a long-term thing and the familiarity breaking down some of the other things, but I have to believe that there's some way in which the mission there in public diplomacy in the State Department in the last few years has been one of saying, look, we've got to do something about the impressions that have built up over the last decade.
Well, part of this is also this word impressions. Impressions are formed in a variety of ways. How do you get an impression of something? Well, you might go to a museum and look at a piece of art and have an impression. You might turn on your television and watch a program that gives you an impression. Part of what public diplomacy is about these last few years is looking at creative new ways to create impressions. And obviously, we're trying to explain what the American experience is. So let me make this concrete for you. I traveled to Pakistan, to Islamabad and Lahore. You could say that U.S.-Pakistan has gone through some rocky relationship times. By going to Pakistan and speaking on Pakistani television and Pakistani radio and meeting with Pakistani bloggers and going to a college and talking to Pakistani women, I found that, yes, our image is negative in many parts of the country, and there is a sense of tension and friction. But I will tell you that at the end of a speech in which the questions were pretty hostile, by the end of the dialogue after the speech, some of those same hostile questioners came up and asked how do they apply for one of those programs so that they could see a college in Seattle or someplace. There's a human curiosity. There's a human drive to know more. And you just have to be willing to stay at this, even in the difficult image times, the difficult perception times, the difficult security times.
Now I want to shift gears to think about our own politics and how that might be influencing the impressions of the messages that the United States is trying to deliver around the world. Have you had the experience where people basically are saying look at the United States' own domestic political problems and then object to the message we're trying to carry forward in the world on the grounds that there's a hypocrisy there just looking at our own domestic.
It's tempting at times to say, well, we're in such a period of divisive political life that how can we communicate strength and unity of purpose? And then something happens that reminds you to avoid and resist that temptation. I had, when I was at the Institute of Peace not too long ago, a panel of African leaders from different countries, and they were all in very difficult Francophone countries. And what they said when they came here is, you are still the model to us of how we want to do our elections and how we want to govern and what we mean by democracy. We shoot each other in the streets in our country. We kidnap and torture and take people out of the country so that they can't vote. There are many people living in IDP camps and refugee camps. And so it was a reminder that, yes, we yell at each other and we have very tough debates, but I still believe we are an example and a light to other nations.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with Undersecretary of State Tara Sonenshine. Well, you mentioned before social media and a story about the hip-hop artist. Are there other approaches and methods outside of social media that you haven't mentioned that we would never normally associate with diplomacy that have been employed? Maybe your favorite example you could give me.
My favorite example was recently the Secretary of State decided to launch the first Chef's Corps. And I couldn't imagine what this was really going to be like. And it was brilliant. It was the use of food and cuisine and the preparation of meals as an international bridge builder. And so you have these chefs from around the world who come here and come to the United States and talk about their culture and heritage and traditions, and then go into, in some cases, poor communities and work in kitchens and hope to train young people who might want to be a chef when they grow up. And I was just amazed at the power of food to set the table, if you will, for cultural connections. And I would say the same on sports diplomacy, which is becoming ever more popular as a way to level the playing field.
I'm going to shift a bit to ask a couple questions about you now and your own experience. I'm curious to hear about how your extensive experience on both sides of the microphone has influenced the way you do your current job. What did your years as a reporter and a producer teach you about being a spokesperson that you might not have learned otherwise?
Being a reporter teaches you to ask tough questions, dig and dig, and it also teaches you to listen very hard for answers and to not always think you know where the conversation or the story will lead.
And flip that around. If you were to go back to the media now, with the experience that you've had at the State Department, what would you know as a reporter that you didn't know before, or a producer?
I would appreciate now as a reporter how hard it is to make policy. I would probably be far less judgmental and far more understanding of how complex it is to reach foreign policy decisions and how many factors and things go into the mix and the stew, and I would probably be less quick to judge.
Is there a way we can take that and make that lesson something that is generally appreciated? Because that does seem to be a problem with our public dialogue about a lot of issues that are involved in foreign relations. I mean, the Benghazi killings in Benghazi would be the most recent one that we would think of. It's just tough to have a rational conversation at the national level about something like that.
My answer is, what we're doing today by having a conversation has to go on now. And it is by virtue of online, but I also think going places, sitting person to person, having a conversation is part of how you move to a more rational place.
And I'm also curious about your experiences in non-governmental organizations that work on diplomacy and peace. Sometimes their work is called unofficial diplomacy. You've had a lot of experience in that as well in your past. What are the advantages and disadvantages of working through non-governmental channels as opposed to governmental channels?
Non-governmental channels give you a little bit more elbow room. You're not, as we talked about in the first segment, constrained by the notion that you are formally a government official. So you can often travel to places where a government official might not be able to go, and you can often work your way into conversations at a different level. What I'll tell you that experience convinced me is people are enormously generous with their time. And when they work in non-governmental organizations, they don't make a lot of money, they work really hard, and they are so motivated and so motivating that I think we have to thank those public service citizens who work in those organizations everywhere around the world.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Discovery. This is a period of discovering new ways of doing things, new appreciation for the field of public diplomacy, discovering countries I hadn't traveled to, cities I hadn't been to. So this is very much a period of discovery.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is to go back to my reporter's on-the-air deadline mentality, which is we got to get this show wrapped, and we got to get off the air at exactly on time. And government doesn't necessarily work that way. The world doesn't necessarily work that way. But I was trained professionally to get on the air and off the air and a good show.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Wow, I was most surprised the first time I got published in a newspaper and had an op-ed published in the New York Times. I never imagined that ordinary citizens could get published in major newspapers. I was a young producer. I had gone to the then Soviet Union and done a story and came back, and with my co-producer, we wrote an article and submitted it. And when I saw that in the newspaper, I thought, wow, never could have imagined that.
That was Tara Sonnenschein. Undersecretary Sonnenschein, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.